Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day.
Good morning, everyone. This is Faith Radio Mornings for the 17th of January. This is our show as part of the Faith Radio Network that we will do our best to cover the news of the day, not necessarily from a conservative or a liberal perspective, though those perspectives will be represented. But regardless of the slant or the direction of a given guest or a given article, we will continue to fix our eyes on Jesus together. He is, after all, the only king of the only kingdom that knows no end. And long after you and I have passed through this earth, Jesus will remain and his kingdom will also stand. I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Rachel Sutton and Paul Perot here for this Thursday morning, enjoying our time together as we're trying to put together guests for you that can talk to some of these different headlines and topics in the news from a specifically Christian angle. And I know our first guest, Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, will be joining us here shortly, and he's our Thursday morning regular contributor, and we've got a lot of news to get to with Ben, so we're going to shorten things up on the intro here this morning, read a quick quote from German theologian Jürgen Moltmann about how Jesus identifies with those who have suffered violence and those who are oppressed, and think in terms of the fact that our political systems and our social systems, for as helpful as they might be at times, really can't invite people to wholeness in the way that Jesus does. And so Moltmann says this in his book, Ethics of Hope. In the raising and exaltation of Jesus, God has chosen the one whom the moral and the political powers of this world rejected. The poor, humiliated, suffering, and forsaken Jesus, God identified himself with him and made him Lord of a new kind of world. The God who creates justice for those who suffer violence, the God who exalts the humiliated and executed Christ, that is the God of hope for the new world of righteousness and justice and peace. And those of us following Jesus get a chance to taste that hope in the midst of our world today while we anticipate the fullness of that hope being consummated at the end of all things. And so we do fix our eyes again on Jesus this morning. Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings.
This is my right, a right given by God, to live a free life, to live in freedom, talking about freedom.
And that, of course, is the music of our good friend, minister and journalist, Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute, who joins us every Thursday morning here on Faith Radio Mornings at the top of our show to get into some of the more important headlines of the day. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Peter.
Always great to have you on the program. And as we get started this morning, I don't know what you're all following in the news these days, but it seems like everywhere I turn, everywhere I click, regardless of what the search engine term might be, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez shows up somehow. It is AOC all day, all the time. Is that what you're seeing too, Ben?
AOC 24/7. You're right.
And in terms of what she's in the news about here recently, and I found this really interesting, and you and I over the past several years have followed the political cycle, of course, and the politicians that are in the news. And yesterday there was a tweet that she sent out in which she was responding to some of her perceived treatment by the right, the conservative right, in some of these news media outlets. And she said, "What have you got left? I'm 6 days into the term, and you already used all your ammo. So enjoy being exhausted for the next 2 years while we run train on the progressive agenda." And Ben, I am not super familiar with some of the vernacular of the day, but my understanding that the phrase run train is quite a vulgar phrase, and yet there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of blowback in terms of her using that kind of phrase like we might have seen with President Trump when he was running or others that have used similarly vulgar terms.
You're exactly right. That is what that term means. That's a vulgar term. I worked in college radio as an adult, and there was actually a song that used that term is the way that I happen to know that phrase. And essentially means, if you think of some of the more extravagant things that Brett Kavanaugh was accused of doing, That's what that term means. So, it's incredibly vulgar. And it's funny, you know, the way that the media goes into histrionics about vulgarity on one side and yet condones it or thinks that it's cute on the other. So, you know, on the one hand, you have, for example, Dick Cheney used the F word, which in a way I don't condone, on the I believe it was on the Senate floor when he was in charge of the vice presidency. And you had John Kerry use the term deliberately in an interview to try and stoke his credentials when he was running for president in 2004. The 2004 Democratic Convention, you had John Kerry, who used the term to get the nomination, bring out a little girl and scold Dick Cheney for using the term. It was a perfect illustration of one of Saul Alinsky's rules. In his Rules for Radicals, he says, always try and hold your opponent to their own rule book. So, you know, those of us who are on the Christian or conservative side or who believe in faith believe that it's unseemly to use that kind of language, certainly not the end of the world, but it's unseemly. And so when President Trump said that certain nations are not the most beautiful places to live, and he used somewhat colorful barnyard kind of language to describe that, they rightly were somewhat exercised about that, but it became a feeding frenzy. Now Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says this, she's still a media darling.
And I think that's such an important point, Ben. And I think you and I both try to stay as fair-minded as we can to look at things as objectively as possible from an evidence standpoint. Of course, we're going to miss it quite often, more than I'd care to admit. But in this particular case, in doing some search around Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and just trying to read some of her policies and where she's coming from, when I do a comparative of the news coverage of her online from all the major outlets compared to, say, President Trump, it really is about 90% in terms of just fawning over her, her potential, her possibility, what she's going to do for our country, all of those things. And by contrast, even since 2015, the coverage of the president has been almost entirely negative.
That's true. The Media Research Center has done studies on this from the very beginning. Every single year, it's between 90 and 92% negative coverage for the president. So it's interesting to use the term 90% for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think that it's been fawning praise. And of course, in many ways, understandably so. She's a 29-year-old. She upset a sitting congressman. So, I mean, it was a praiseworthy accomplishment. What's troubling is the fact that she has a manifest knowledge deficit around certain issues which are profoundly important, where there was her interview with Firing Line with Margaret Hoover, where she didn't understand the term of occupation, which she had just used in the previous sentence, or whether she understands the difference between billions and trillions of dollars, or whether it's which branches of government we have, or whether it's the difference between a successful economy and a socialist economy that is going to destroy the economic prosperity that we have in this country. I'm most concerned not so much about her language, but about her proposals. And her proposals concern me tremendously.
Yeah, and I've already started to see some headlines that predict her as president in 2024 when she's eligible to run at that point in time. And, Ben, are you just sort of noticing a bit of a momentum around some of her policies? Things have swung so far left that even an approximation of where she is seems to be where some of the momentum is in the political cycle right now.
Well, truly is. She went on 60 Minutes, of course, just a few weeks ago and told Anderson Cooper she believed in a 70% top marginal tax rate. So, as she so eloquently put it, at, quote, like the tippy tops of the income distribution. And you know, what she was talking about was millions upon millions of dollars would pay 70% and up. Julian Castro, who just announced he's forming a presidential exploratory committee, former HUD secretary under Barack Obama, essentially he's running to be vice president on somebody else's ticket. He has no chance of getting the nomination. But a young, attractive young male with a very bright future, both he and his brother, came out and said, why not 90%? So he's doubling down, moving the Overton window as far left as possible. And the reason should be very clear, which is these high tax rates destroy economic activity. They confiscate money from people who have earned it, often in order to give it to people in a way that would be destructive to them. As we've seen, welfare programs have decimated the inner city. They've decimated in parts of rural America, such as where I live. Where you see the opioid addiction epidemic, in many cases that goes hand in hand with people who are either on disability or various other programs. And you know, in addition to all of that, it would impede human flourishing on a massive scale. So those are the issues that are really concerning to me. And you've seen the entire Democratic Party essentially debating between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks at this point.
That's the voice of Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. Ben, other news coming out of Washington, D.C., of course, we have the ongoing government partial shutdown, and it just seems to keep going and going and going. And, of course, here recently we see the newly appointed Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, suggesting that union address or President Trump, the State of the Union address, should be delayed until after the shutdown is resolved.
And so these people are not working. And we've never really had a State of the Union when government has been in a shutdown since the Budget Act in the 70s.
I thought about that a little bit, Ben, in terms of wondering if the speaker has a point in this issue, because it seems like it might be an awkward speech to give when we sort of have this looming specter of an ongoing shutdown with no real resolution in sight. What was your take on her comments and the possibility of the union address?
I think this is her trying to step on Donald Trump's toes in so many ways. First of all, this is the State of the Union is the president's moment to shine. He gets to unveil his agenda. There's always a response, but the response never does as well as the original speech. There are just too many difficulties in the way of it. So this is really the president's moment to shine, to get a balance, and particularly in the middle of a shutdown like this over a contentious issue, to get his point across. So I think that he would use the State of the Union to his maximum advantage to do that. And she's trying her best to delay that in order not to give him the political advantage. Second of all, I think that another thing behind this is the idea that government is the most important part of our lives, that if the government's not working, nothing happens. Everything has to grind to a halt. You saw this during the last government shutdown when Barack Obama closed things that don't close during a government shutdown. He prevented veterans from going into national parks when they had defended the nation for which those parks had been erected and perhaps fought in the wars that those monuments stood for. So the idea is that if government is being shut down and government is the center of their idea, then the entire country should be suffering in some way and the president should pay for it. Of course, the State of the Union traditionally had been submitted in writing up until 1913. That was the first time it was ever delivered in person since George Washington, I believe, or John Adams. Woodrow Wilson revived it in 1913. There have been times where it has been delayed, and there have been times when it's simply been submitted in writing. If Donald Trump wants to humor this, and I wouldn't, but if he really wanted to humor it, I could see I would be very careful if I were Nancy Pelosi offering this opportunity, because I could see him go down to the border and give a speech where he would do something that would truly be unprecedented.
Yeah,
he should have.
Yeah, just going to say, I think it's a great
angel families. and let them deliver part of the State of the Union and then run Jim Acosta's clip about how the border works.
Yeah, just remind our listeners of that from last week, Ben. That was quite a moment for Acosta, who obviously is no friend of the White House and seemed to be trying to make a point, and he actually supported the president in his point on that one.
Inadvertently, Jim Acosta of CNN, of course, the most acrimonious member of the press corps in terms of his relationship with the president, went down to the border and he saw where there was a portion where there were steel slats on the border. And he said, we see, here's a wall, but there is no emergency. There are no teeming groups of, there's no caravan trying to steam across it. There are no groups of migrants coming across in any way, shape, or form. It's peaceful and tranquil. And everyone said, point made. That's what a wall does. They go someplace else. And if we had a wall across the whole border, they'd have to find another way to get in. So it certainly blew up in his face on that case. It sort of reminded me of Balaam being forced to bless Israel when he intended to curse.
Well, Ben, you and I have been in media for quite some time. And with all the mistakes that we've made over the years, that one made me chuckle and made me feel much better about myself.
Certainly. Mine have been mostly tongue twisters.
Absolutely. Well, it was fun to chat with you again this morning. Let's take a short break. When we come back, you referenced the role of government in our lives. And it's not just a question for the United States of America, but you released a really interesting article on your site, acton.org. And it's about how in Germany, the government is thinking about denying homeschool families the ability to teach if they're not going to teach principles of tolerance in their curriculum. So I need to ask you about that next here on Faith Radio Mornings.
No matter where I'm going.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're chatting with Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute this morning. And Ben, you released a pretty interesting article here on the 14th of January chronicling what's going on in Germany and government sort of interference in homeschool families there, especially when it comes to some of the social values of the day.
Unfortunately, the Wunderlich family in Germany had a setback. The European Court of Human Rights ruled against them. The Wunderlich family homeschools their five children, and in 2012, the state intervened. In Germany, homeschooling is illegal except in the most strict of cases. If someone is too ill and has a communicable illness or some kind of terrible disability and can't get to school, or for child actors when they're on the set, that's essentially the only condition in which someone can be homeschooled. They had been homeschooling regardless, and the German government had heard rumors from people that they were not being educated at a proper level, and they went to interview the father, and the father said these children are not the property of the state. The person who wrote it down wrote that he had said the children were his property and went to the worst possible interpretation of that, that he would kill them because they are his property and he would treat them like they were property. So 35 agents stormed their home in Germany. Both police officers, social agents, they separated the family for 3 weeks, ran a battery of tests. As it turned out, of course, none of the charges were accurate. The children had contact with people outside the family. There were no physical harm whatsoever, and none of them had an educational deficit. But in order to get the children back, the family had to agree to put the children back in a government-run school. And at various times, they have reneged on that and begun homeschooling the children again. The government took away their right. They only granted them partial parental custody so that they couldn't take them to another country like France that allows homeschooling, which they thought about doing. In order to prevent them from leaving the government system, they prevented them from leaving the nation. And ultimately, the European Court of Human Rights had ruled that the court had acted rightly in separating a family, removing children from their parental home for 3 weeks, and in banning homeschooling because ultimately, what it came down to, according to the court ruling, is that they were afraid that they would not learn certain important social skills, such as tolerance, quote unquote. And in order to learn tolerance, you have to be exposed to other viewpoints besides your parents' point of view. So if a parent teaches to, reading between the lines, if a parent teaches what they believe and particularly say from the Christian perspective and doesn't teach the Hindu perspective or the Muslim perspective or the Zoroastrian perspective, that's intolerant, and the child should be removed, if necessary, from the home and forced into a school where the state will teach its enforced orthodoxy. The fact of the matter is education is the prime importance. It's the primary role of the parents to do that for the child, not of the government. In the scriptures, it says, raise up a child in the way he should go. Teach them in these precepts as you in the morning and in the evening and as you walk along the way. It is our duty as parents to teach our children and to inculcate them in our faith. And if we wish to do so in the home, that is certainly without any trouble. And children who are homeschooled can tell you some can be socially isolated. There is no need to be socially isolated whatsoever. They're some of the most well-adjusted, well-behaved, and well-informed people I've ever met have been homeschooled, including my own children.
Well, certainly Rachel Sutton here in studio, one of the producers, she was homeschooled, and she is nodding fervently with you this morning, Ben. You are speaking her language. I think she sees herself as terribly socially adjusted at this point.
I certainly always come across that way, and working in media, I think it helps, yeah.
Absolutely.
If you're socially adjusted, able to communicate as she is.
We have a couple minutes left here, Ben, but you bring up such an important point, and I know having graduated with an education degree, having been involved in public schools, and I have such respect for teachers doing what they're doing with kids and all of the currents that they're navigating, but it was interesting when we got involved on more of the government and sometimes the administrative levels that there was an assumption, and we were even sort of taught this way, that we as teachers knew better than the parents, and that's a pretty subtle but really, really important message to at least mention that there is an arrogance sometimes from the government that they know best.
Certainly, and particularly when it comes to issues like schooling. As you said, when students go into the classroom, teachers are expected to look at various backgrounds, to look out for them, make sure that they're doing well. And I don't have any trouble with that. I don't think anyone does. The issue is that when you get beyond certain aspects of thriving and get into when the government has overarched itself, particularly in this case, into learning whether the people are tolerant or not. The fact of the matter is that if someone has a religious point of view that doesn't happen to accord, be in full accord with the state-sponsored indifference to all religious beliefs and all lifestyles and every moral choice that can be made, that shouldn't reflect poorly on the child. That's exactly the core of Western civilization that's made America and the West and Germany great.
Well, Ben, it's always great to chat with you in terms of some of these headlines and just bringing a balanced topic, but also from a distinctly Christian perspective. I appreciate just all the time you've taken, all the energy you've put into Faith Radio Mornings over these last several months.
Well, thank you, and God bless.
We'll take a break here for some Lighten Up and bottom of the hour news. And when we come back for the second half of this hour, we're going to have a special appearance by our good friend, Dr. David Aikman, coming to us out of Ireland. And David is going to give us some updates on the Brexit situation, as well as some of the news coming out of Syria. Well, as we've talked about here on Faith Radio Mornings, we see that more Americans are feeling the strain as the partial government shutdown enters day 27. It is unprecedented territory. The government has never been shut down in any form for this period of time. Everything from food inspections and airport security to automobile safety and national parks have been affected, along with 800,000 federal workers who aren't getting paid. And some new implications just coming out here this morning is that it sounds like it's 5 weeks until the Food and Drug Administration says that they are out of money for approving new drugs. So I'm sure that the rippling impact will continue to be felt for as long as this shutdown continues. Yesterday, Bill English joined us here on Faith Radio Mornings. Bill, of course, is a regular Wednesday morning guest, BibleandBusiness.com, and he talked about living without financial security, but in God's security and promises.
You know, I came out of my business in 2014 with a whole truckload of debt because I had to sell it at a loss. So I'm not a rich man.
Yeah.
So I know what it's like to live hand to mouth. Been doing it literally for about 6 years now. It's a really tough place, but an enviable place to be when you're genuinely resting in your trust in God to provide for you. When you realize that your job is not as secure as God's promises, when you realize that that God loves you more than you love yourself, for heaven's sakes, and that he has promised to provide, there's a security there that you can't get any other way.
Bill always has so many helpful tips for those people involved in the business world or just even wondering about how to handle money and to be good stewards of it, but not necessarily be owned by the money, that just sort of part of what makes the world go round, unfortunately. If you want to catch his entire segment, you can head to myfaithradio.com and search for Bill English, anything around BibleandBusiness.com, and hear all of what Bill had to say in his 15 minutes yesterday. Well, up next, we're going to be joined by special guest, at least a special guest for a Thursday. That's Dr. David Aikman, who normally joins us on Mondays. But we're going to be taping Martin Luther King Day Jr. show for Monday, and we wanted to get David in for today instead. And what great timing, because we got to talk about the ongoing Brexit situation. Lots of news coming out of the United Kingdom.
If you're inclined to step back from anything that might sound political, hear me out. This is Jim Garlow. The same Word of God, the Bible, that speaks to our individual lives, our family life, our church life, also speaks to our schools, our workplaces, our communities, local, state, and even federal government. There's no major issue that God's Word does not provide basic and transcendent truth. It was God who first thought of it and even described government in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, as being on the shoulder of the incarnated Son. When government is mentioned, don't start running. It creates great delight in the evil one who desires any areas we want to surrender to him. Our sovereign king does not yield to the evil one, and he never intended for us to do so either. This is not a call to be more political. It's actually a plea to be more biblical. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
My name is Bond, James Bond.
Twenty-two minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and that intro means that Dr. David Aikman is joining us. David, of course, wrote for Time Magazine for the better part of 20 years, covering global affairs for them, now as one of the editors for Godspeed Magazine. I really recommend that site if you want to, as a believer, get some really credible news from a Christian standpoint. Head to Godspeed Magazine and just search for that through the internet. So, David, thanks for joining us here. Are you a little disoriented? It's a Thursday morning instead of a Monday morning. Everything okay?
Well, Now, all these holidays, I'm used to rescheduling interviews more, but I'm disorientated because the events going on in London are absolutely crazy right now, and I know we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah, it was incredible to follow it this week. It seems like an endless flow of news. First, we saw that Theresa May's proposal for Brexit was roundly defeated from pretty much all directions in the Parliament. It wasn't just people who wanted to stay within the European Union, but you had one side saying that we should stay closer to the European Union, and the other side saying it didn't go far enough from untying the United Kingdom from the European Union. So she lost by about 230 votes on that. What was your sort of first reaction when you saw how significant the loss was?
Well, it was absolutely gigantic. No British government has been voted out on a major platform of its program for more than 100 years. So this is just unprecedented. And poor old Theresa May, valiant and courageous as she is, has to cope with an almost insoluble situation, which I'll explain little by little if you want to go that way.
Yeah, just give us at least a kind of a thumbnail sketch of that. I think it'd be important because we see some of these headlines, David, but to get into the inner mechanics of it is something that we don't often hear.
Right. Well, the issue is that, of course, the leave vote, the vote to leave the EU, won by 52% to 48% who wanted to remain. But the leave vote was the highest number of English people who'd vote, or British people, I'd say, who'd voted in any electoral event before. And these people, you know, they had various different reasons for leaving, but they definitely wanted to leave. Now, the Remain vote, which was 48%, was limited, well, I wouldn't say limited, but was mostly focused around London, the south of England, the more cosmopolitan areas of the country who did a lot of business with the European Union. And the paradox is that the members of Parliament who voted for the referendum in the first place, they are in a majority very much pro-Remain. So there's a lot of feeling that the Remainers, as they're called, or sometimes people call them the Ramoners, are absolutely determined to stop Britain leaving, even though the outcome of the referendum showed that the British clearly wanted to leave. So now what we've got down to is this, that Theresa May, after her loss in the House of Commons last week, and then after the success in the vote of no confidence, which means that the government can still continue in office, she said that she'd reach out to opposition parties to get their views on how to deal with this issue. And the real core of the thing is, should we have a new deal with the EU if the EU would be willing to negotiate that? And for the most part, they've said absolutely not. We don't want to renegotiate the thing. Or should they be willing to have no deal? Now, here is where it gets complicated, because the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, absolutely wants to take the no deal option off the table. That's his red line. And he refuses to sit down in meetings of cross-party delegations with Theresa May because he thinks the no deal option would be such a catastrophe for the British economy that everybody would suffer terribly. So it's really at a stalemate. And Theresa May has another vote coming up next week on whatever her plan B is. Could she decide, well, no deal is an option? Because she previously said a bad deal is worse than no deal. So, in effect, she might be willing to sign a bill to jump off the cliff on March 29th when Britain officially leaves the EU. And we'll have to see how it works out, but it's a very strange phenomenon. British politics is really divided in a very serious way. And it's so peculiar that you see BBC interviewers talking to members of parliament outside the parliament building, and almost drowning out the interview are people shouting, "No to Brexit, no Brexit, we want to remain." And occasionally you get chants from the other point of view, "We want to leave." But it's a very almost hysterical grassroots reaction to the confusion that's taking place in British politics.
It really is something to watch right now, David. And having followed British politics for, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, it always seemed to me that when there was debate going on, the debate could be pretty rigorous and vigorous between different parties, but it seemed to be with a bit of a twinkle in the eye as well. And that maybe even was true historically of American politics, but it sure seems like both in America and in Britain that there really is an authentic divisiveness between the two sides.
That's absolutely true. And it's reflected both in the parliamentary discussion and in the public discussion. So I don't know what the answer is, but clearly we need some political party or some political leader who can wave the flag and rally people around him to move forward in the direction that they think that he will give leadership to go in.
Having a special surprise visit from Dr. David Aikman this morning here for Thursday morning. Normally joins us on Mondays on Faith Radio Mornings, talking about some of the pretty significant events in the Brexit situation and, of course, anticipating the possibility of a hard Brexit on the 29th of March, where the United Kingdom would crash out of the European Union without any specific trade agreements. And, David, I'm sure we'll be covering those things in the weeks and months ahead on Faith Radio Mornings. There is some other news that I'd like to get to here after a short break, and those are some events that happened last night in Syria. Of course, the United States is withdrawing from Syria. We've seen a declaration that ISIS has been routed and defeated, and yet the headlines last night was that ISIS claimed responsibility for an attack that killed four Americans. So I'd love to get your perspective on that next on Faith Radio Mornings. It's about 11 minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Peter Kapsner, enjoying a surprise visit by Dr. David Aikman, who, again, normally joins us on Mondays, but it's great to have him on a Thursday morning. Lots to get to. And, David, I'm not sure if you followed a lot of the events here in the last 24 hours out of Syria, but some pretty troubling news in terms of some bombings there that killed four Americans, and ISIS is claiming responsibility. What are you seeing in the situation?
Well, I think, as a lot of people predicted, ISIS, even if it lost control of the cities in Syria and Iraq that it had briefly taken over beginning in 2014, would never be completely defeated, in the sense that it would be able to mount suicide attacks not only in Syria and Iraq, but in many other parts of the world, including Europe and the U.S. So, unfortunately, those predictions have come true, and it does require careful rethinking of how the U.S. plans its withdrawal.
In terms of what we see moving forward, in terms of who would fill the vacuum of power there, I know that the president has suggested Turkey can do that, and Assad is, of course, still ruling in Syria. With the United States, if they continue to leave sort of this vacuum behind, what would potentially happen in terms of the regrowth of ISIS? What do we see moving forward if the United States does remove its presence?
Well, I think we're going to see something of a power vacuum developing, in which the Turks move in to protect their own borders from what they suspect are Kurdish-initiated attacks on themselves, and they're going to take some of the burden of trying to move against ISIS groups. But I think also the Russians are going to stiffen the resolve of the Syrian regime to really try to clamp down in a way that makes these suicide attacks not possible anymore.
Well, and it's not just in Syria that we see some of this too, Dr. Aikman, but obviously there are some events earlier this week out of Nairobi and Kenya in which we saw 15 killed in a hotel attack. And so terrorism continues to rear its head, even despite the best attempts to stomp it out. What did we see in the Kenya situation?
Well, of course, Al-Shabaab, who has claimed responsibility for the Nairobi attacks, is on the extreme end of all Islamist groups operating throughout the world. And unfortunately, if they attack a soft target like a hotel in a capital city, they're bound to wreak casualties, which they did. And I think you can't have the same solution to every situation where you have these attacks going on. But other than trying to stiffen the resolve of the Kenyan government to really clamp down on these ISIS followers and terrorists, I don't think it's feasible to have any outside military unit trying to do it for them.
And David, and when we think about Israel and the impact that this might have in the Middle East, I know you and I talked about on Monday a little bit that Israel, sort of in an interesting development, claim responsibility for an attack. It was a targeted attack, but rarely do they do that sort of thing. And we're watching some trends here in the United States where certainly on the Democratic side of things, we're seeing a bit more of a, not necessarily anti-Israel, but there is a sense in which there's a belief that the United States has become too cozy again with Israel. What happens if the United States removes their presence from the Middle East and there's not a lot of political will here left among Congress to get involved again? Israel ends up kind of standing alone, don't they?
Well, I think that would be a catastrophic development because Israel is able to defend itself and has done very effectively. But one of the reasons it has continued to do so, in spite of intense opposition from the UN, the European Union, and other quarters, is that the United States has got its back, provides the military equipment and resources that Israel needs, and moreover, the political will to support the Israeli government in power at this time. So I think it's unfortunate that the Democratic Party seems to be moving to a more a less supportive position regarding Israel than it previously had.
And David, you obviously are in Europe and part of the United Kingdom, well, at least in Ireland, so part of the European Union, actually. Is there a lot of support for Israel in that part of Western civilization, or is it pretty sort of apathetic throughout the European Union?
Well, it's very interesting because in the UK, there's quite a lot of support for Israel. And when it comes to Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic, there's a striking contrast. In the parts of Belfast, which are lived in by prominent pro-nationalist, pro-Irish Republican Army people, you can see Irish Republican flags and the flag of the Palestinians. But in the Protestant areas, the people who want to stay part of the UK, you find not only the Union flag of Great Britain, but you have Israeli flags flying. So it's really split along sort of sectarian nationalist factions throughout the continent.
Well, and some other items out of the EU, as we have just a couple minutes left here, too. I'd be just curious your take on some of the events coming out of France. We've seen quite a bit of populist protest of the Macron there and with the Yellow Vest movement. And it sure seems like, again, there's not a lot of end or to this whole populist uprising, both in France, the United States, obviously the United Kingdom, Germany, places like this. And there's been conversation that the EU is on the front end of unraveling altogether. Is that a little bit too extreme of a position, or is that possible at this point?
I don't think it is too extreme. I mean, I think there's such a lot of unrest at the grassroots, such a lot of indecision. But I think the larger issue is that the EU remains fundamentally an undemocratic organization. The committee of the Council of Ministers and the European Commission in Brussels makes decisions that affect the lives of millions of people in scores of countries under their domain. And ordinary people just feel completely cut off from the normal functions of democratic governance. That, of course, is the main reason why so many British people voted to leave the EU. But I think that sentiment is probably on the increase in many EU member states.
Well, we certainly appreciate your perspective and coming from kind of the ground level in the EU so we can, from outside looking in, understand a bit more what's happening. David, thanks for joining us on a Thursday morning like this. We'll miss you next Monday, but look forward to catching up again a week from Monday here on Faith Radio Mornings.
Thank you very much, Peter.
We'll take a short break here, wrap up our first hour of the show, and preview what's coming up for hour two here on the 17th of January on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, it doesn't seem to get much better than Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, followed by Dr. David Aikman, Godspeed Magazine, to get started in the morning to talk about so many of these news headlines from a distinctively Christian and trustworthy, and I would suggest credible standpoint. The two of them have been involved in news and have critically analyzed the news for so many different years. It's just a real privilege to have them on the program. Of course, coming up in hour two here on a Thursday morning at the start of the hour, I'll be joined by Professor Jim Bilby, who teaches Christian theology, has been an author of many, many books, and just has a great perspective on so many issues. And we will do our Ask Anything segment, and I'll ask Jim a little bit about if Christians really do have a role to be the moral police in society.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.